Hello, Garland Nixon and Scott Ritter here to do a special battlefield update. There's things going on around Solidar, and we're going to talk about it. Let's chat. All right, Scott, let's get right to it. There in the center is the town of Solidar, which is just, I believe, north or just outside of Bakhmut. There is a lot of talk today about Solidar. So for those who don't, who haven't, I've looked at this map before. I'm sure you're familiar with the area. But for those who haven't, who don't know anything about the location, is Solid, for starters, is that an important town in the battle for Donbas? And if so, why would it be important or not important at this time?
Well, I mean, first of all, the twin, I call them twin cities, twin urban areas of Solidar and Bakhmut are the site of two very large underground salt mines. I think the Solidar mine's been out of action for some time, but and parts of it have been converted. They've played back in 2007. I think the Donetsk Orchestra played a concert down there. They have carvings. There's a church, but it's underground. And I think Bakhmut salt mine was active up till at least 2014. But since then, they've been converted into a logistics command and control and defensive hub. Both areas have been heavily fortified, extensive trench work, bunkers, reinforcing fires, and it serves as the sort of the key to the Ukrainian defenses. So the fall of either Solidar, Bakhmut, or both would be devastating for the Ukrainians, because the defensive line that they had spent 8 years building since 2014 will have been broken. I liken it to the Gordian knot. Once cut, the defenses will collapse, because the Russians will be able to pivot north or south and just roll up the Ukrainian defenses. The Ukrainians will have no choice but to withdraw and build defensive lines elsewhere. There's indications that they already have begun to do that, but these defensive lines will not have anywhere near the kind of complexity that Bakhmut and Solidar had. And battles tend to define themselves. Both sides have poured in considerable resources into this battle. There's a lot of bloggers out there, especially on the Russian side, or Russian slash Ukrainian side, who knows. Who have been critical of the Russian high command, in particular Prigozhin, the head of Wagner, for pouring so many resources into this, into what has been, by all accounts, an extraordinarily bloody battle on both sides. But one has to remember that even though it's bloody on both sides, we're talking 8-to-1, 10-to-1 casualty ratios in favor of Russia. It's literally a meat grinder for the Ukrainians, who have put some of their best units into the defense of these twin cities. And if counts are right, I mean, Solidar has been all but surrounded. And I think Zelensky gave a speech tonight where he alluded to the need to evacuate Solidar to preserve the surviving troops, or else lose them. And he can't afford to lose these guys. But he said, the battle for Solidar has bought us time to rebuild our army. So he's alluding to, the probability that Ukraine has withdrawn forces to the rear, who are currently being trained and equipped by NATO. Yeah, time would be a valuable asset. But whatever forces he's building, I can't imagine they're more than a couple brigades. We need to remember that while Russia's carrying out this battle, this victorious battle, by the way, they're winning in Bakhmut and Solidar. About 150, 175,000 fresh Russian forces are finalizing their training, their equipping, their organization, and 10 to 15 division equivalents of Russians are getting ready to descend on the special military operations, zone of operations. And I just feel that there will completely overwhelm whatever reserves the Ukrainians have been able to accumulate during this so-called pause. And again, I always, you know, military math, if you're reconstituting three brigades, but you have to sacrifice five brigades to do that, that's even a Marine knows that that's just bad math. You're not going to be able to sustain that. So I think we're looking at a very dramatic, victory for the Russians. And I think it's going to coincide with the arrival of forces. Again, the bloggers are very critical because apparently they sit next to a General Serovokin, a Viking, and they know. They're sitting there going, oh, my God, General Armageddon, why are you moving so slow? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? And I'm sure he tells them everything. The answer is no. I can't speak for the Russians because I'm not there. But, you know, I have planned extraordinarily complicated military operations from the corps level on down to battalion level. And sequencing is everything. The importance of sequencing your actions to create a accumulation of power so that everything coincides at a given point in time. You don't want to achieve a breakthrough if you don't have the forces available to exploit the breakthrough, because once you achieve the breakthrough, the Ukrainians will respond. And when the forces come in, the opportunities won't be there. So I can imagine a situation where the Russians are sitting there, you know, grinding and saying, back off, not so fast, back off, hold back, let them reinforce. People are going, why are you letting them bring more troops in? Because it ain't time yet. Right. So we're gonna let them come in. We're going to begin the process again, grind them down, and then move forward again. And if they go too fast, pull it back, hold off. Is this frustrating for outsiders? Yeah. Is it frustrating for the troops on the ground? Somewhat, but they should be briefed. I would imagine the Russians are as professional as we are, and that the frontline assault troops are very cognizant of what the goals and objectives are and what the timing is. And, and so they understand that if they go too fast, that causes problems. And, you know, sometimes going too fast isn't a product of you getting it wrong. It's the product of the enemy losing the will to fight. And then you seek to exploit that. But now you have to pull back. And I just see the Russians being very professional in this regard, unlike their bloggers. I don't think the bloggers are being very professional at all. But the Russian general staff, I think, has their act together. Are they perfect? No general staff ever is, especially from the private level. I'll just tell you right now, every private, corporal, sergeant, staff sergeant, gunnery sergeant, lieutenant, captain on the front line, if you got them in private, they would give you an earful about how incompetent the leadership is. The leadership's always incompetent until they win the war. And then it's the best damn leader I ever served under. And I would imagine that many of the Russians feel that way. I think Wagner, one of the interesting things is Wagner's being presented to the West in a way it's never been presented before. You know, we've always cheapened it as a private military contractor. Mercenaries. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, they're not mercenaries. Just stop it. Stop it already. They're contract soldiers. They just have a different contract vehicle than your other Russian soldier. These are guys who, Wagner was formed in 2014 for a specific purpose. That is to provide a vehicle for the provision of professional military assistance to the Donbas, to the Donetsk People's Militia, Lugansk People's Militia. The Russian army couldn't be there for constitutional reasons, for legal reasons, for optics. But the militias desperately needed professional stiffening in the face of a Ukrainian military that outclassed them, not in terms of bravery. But it doesn't matter how brave you are. If you lack the weapons, the tactics, the doctrine, and you're just going on sheer guts alone, you're probably going to end up holding those guts, stuffing them back into your belly when you got shot doing the wrong thing. So The Wagner was created to provide a contracting vehicle for the provision of professional military services to the Donbas. My understanding is they report directly to the Russian general staff, the high command. My other understanding is at least one of their bases is co-located to a Spetsnaz brigade near Moscow, and that there's a lot of interoperability between these highly trained special forces guys and the Wagner guys. But Wagner's more than just special forces. They're assault troops. And, you know, this means they have tanks, they have artillery, they have their own air force. They fly Su-24 Fencer aircraft. They have their own intelligence, their own drones. You know, it's a self-contained combat unit with extraordinary elan, esprit de corps. You know, what Wagner has done is create an identity. And that identity is such that when you fight for Wagner, you will not let Wagner down. You will not betray Wagner. That there's a code of, you know, not just code of conduct, but there's a code that you won't let your brother fighters down. You know, so these guys do things that I only see in the West, and you know, Marines do this sort of thing. I mean, the Taliban used to say, don't shoot at the Marines because they run toward the bullets. Unlike the Army and everybody else that's tended to go down and return fire long distance, the Marines just went, screw you, we're coming right at you. Maneuver, come in and kill you. Wagner seems to have that kind of spirit, a very aggressive spirit, not suicidal, right, but aggressive. Right. And they've suffered significant casualties as a result. You can't help but suffer casualties if you are aggressively pursuing offensive operations in a built-up area, but not just a built-up area, the most heavily defended point on Earth, right there. Soledar, Bakhmut, all these armchair warriors that sit back there and say, I could have taken this 3 years ago, or I would do this, I would do that. I don't know, man, unless you're there seeing it. And I'm not. I'm just going off of what I read. But, you know, I just remember in our I know I'm going to give a story, and all the combat veterans out there are going to go, oh, God, what a loser. Okay, I admit it. I don't have the same close with and destroy combat history as all you tough warriors out there. All I know is that when we trained for the you know, destruction of a built-up area, pillboxes and all that stuff during the three-day war at the basic school, we always died. We always died. We got it wrong the first time. We got it wrong the second time. We got it wrong the third time. It wasn't until after, you know, multiple repetitions were we able to get the sequencing correct to enable us to reduce a fortified position and retain enough combat power to move on. And this is in peacetime. This is in training. Wagner's having that same lesson. But when you make a mistake, you're dead. And so, you know, they have the Wagner troops right now. Remember, our guys who have done this repeatedly and they've survived, they now have the winning formula. They now know how to do this. And I think it makes them some of the most dangerous people on the planet, because if you can master war, that kind of war, urban combat with the kind of intensity that's going on, because even though the Ukrainians are losing, they still have tanks, still have artillery, still have aircraft. And they will slap you down if you give them the opportunity. And, you know, the fact that Wagner is out there winning, prevailing right now, tells you something. They're pretty darn good.
So if Soledar falls, you know, that because, you know, we've been told the prize is Bakhmut. If Soledar, it appears now that we and could be wrong, but it certainly the evidence shows that Soledar is maybe soon falling. It could be, you know, we've heard this any day, any hour, could be a week, but it certainly appears as though it's vulnerable. Soledar drops and it is taken by the, you know, the Ukrainian troops withdraw. How long can Bakhmut stand? If it's going to be start getting close to being encircled, it's going to be very difficult to resupply the troops and to reinforce the troops in Bakhmut, isn't it, if Soledar falls?
I believe so. I believe that when Soledar falls, and it could be as soon as tonight, that Bakhmut will fall shortly thereafter, because you're putting the Ukrainians in an untenable position. They've lost one of their anchors. So now the Ukrainians have to build new lines of defense that aren't to protect the northern flank of Bakhmut that aren't going to be as defensible as what Soledar was. And the other thing to remember is once retreat is addictive, not in a good way. Defeat is bad. And when, you know, even the best troops, when you, there was a scene again, because I don't have the elite combat experience of all those guys that fought in Iraq and Afghanistan during the Gulf War, I can only refer to, you know, lessons learned from the cinema. I'm at least being honest about it.
Yeah.
You know, but the Band of Brothers had an interesting episode about, you know, what happened after Arnhem, after, you know, they parachuted into the Netherlands and they took a bridge, and now they're fighting the Germans. And the Germans, they attacked a village, the Germans counterattacked, and the Americans had to retreat. I mean, they weren't all killed. Some were killed, some were wounded, but they had to retreat. And the soldiers in there were just like, this sucks, because they were so used to winning. And now they've that stuff. And had the Germans pressed the attack, it would have sucked even more, because once you start retreating, you're in disarray. Right. It's very difficult for you to be able to pivot back and reorganize. You're scattered. Your logistics aren't good. Your command and control's not good. And an aggressive enemy will just stay on you and push you and press you. And it just, you know, mistakes compound, and now you have a problem. And I think this is going to be what's going to happen to the Ukrainians. Again, I think, you know, when we talk about the timing of a potential major Russian offensive, I'm going to shift gears here right now, but there's a reason why I'm doing it.
Okay.
Let's talk about Belarus for a second. We have the Russians.
I think I know why you're doing it. I'm listening.
Building up a significant military presence together. It's a joint operational group with the Belarusian military. They're training together. They're operating together. And they are going to hold major exercises, sort of like the final test. When you build a big group like this, you have to test them, make sure everything works, command and control, everything works as planned. They all know how they function together. So there's going to be this test, this major exercise that terminates on February 1st. Now, you know, I'm not as clever as some people. Maybe there's people out there that can articulate how you go from a major exercise and just immediately transition into offensive operations. I will tell you that that's probably a lot more difficult than it sounds, and probably not going to happen. So the fact that Russia has announced these exercises tells me that you're probably not going to see major offensive action, the kind of exploitation action, till after February 1st.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that the Russian group in Belarus is going to drive on Kiev, drive on the Western border, whatever. It means that they'll be prepared to do whatever they're being tasked to do. And I think their number one task is to sit there and look really, 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 really threatening. And already the Ukrainians are paying attention. The head of the Ukrainian intelligence is like, well, if they come down, we built these fortifications from the border to Kiev. You know, we're ready for them. Well, to be ready for them, you not only have to have built the fortifications, you have to man them, which means manpower, precious manpower, has to be allocated for this defense. And this defense isn't just in Kiev. It's got to extend to the Polish border, which means these are troops that aren't going to be available elsewhere. And I think that's the single most important thing of this group of forces, is the potential for action that forces Ukraine to maintain forces that are capable of responding to that. The other thing it does is it also tells Poland, don't get involved. Poland right now is, you know, they're building up a new armored division. It's going to take them some time, but, you know, at least on paper, it looks good. They're getting the Abrams tank. They're buying the Abrams equivalent from South Korea. They're getting modern artillery from Czech Republic, the Crab. You know, and also on paper, it's going to look good, an armored division. And once that division gets up and running, you know, there's a lot of people that are saying, well, you know, that division is going to make a run on Western Ukraine and try to seize it. Well, that division has a 0% chance of success against the combined Russian-Belarusian military grouping. And the fact that grouping's there and not committed to an offensive against Kiev holds the polls at bay. So I think this group has a job to just sit there and be a force in readiness, ready to do anything and just look threatening. And it's going to freeze the polls, freeze the Ukrainians. And now we come back to where we were back on in the Donbas with the Battle of Bakhmut and Soledar. I think the timing is going to be around February, or the week after February 1st. I think right about that time is when you're going to see the Russians having accumulated sufficient force to exploit a victory. Yes, they're going to win in Soledar, but I don't see them rapidly moving out. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they have accumulated some ready reserves that are ready to do that, but you don't want to go too soon without sufficient forces. Russia's already learned this price. You bite off too much, you have insufficient forces assigned to the task, and you create problems. Right now, they put Ukraine in the situation where they have insufficient forces. It's going to be some time till they get those reinforcements that they're talking about. So I think Russia is going to find the sweet spot in terms of the calendar when their forces are accumulated, if Ukrainian forces aren't accumulated, and the battlefield is going to be developed in a way that creates potential for rapid exploitation. And I think that their primary focus is going to be on securing the remainder of Donetsk, and then securing Zaporizhia. And I think when you talk about even securing Lugansk, which physically Lugansk is almost 100% in control of the Russian forces, but artillery can still be fired. So the Russians have said they need to push the Ukrainians back beyond artillery range, which is probably 100 plus kilometers. And the second you start saying that, that means Kharkov comes into play. So I really think the initial focus is going to be securing Donetsk, securing Lugansk, and then taking Kharkov. Once that happens, I think they roll down, they secure the rest of Zaporizhia, they retake Kherson, and then they'll make a move on Nikolaev. And when they take Nikolaev, they're ready to move towards Odessa. And then I think there's going to be a pause, because I think this is going to probably take them probably all spring into early summer. So I think there'll be a pause there to regroup, but also to give Ukraine a chance to surrender.
What do you think about my, because now that argues that, okay, Ukraine continues to stand and fight, and, you know, which may happen. But you know, there's a term I've been using for a while. And this is the way I see this thing going at some point, and that is collapse. At some point, this Ukraine project, military, political, you know, the United States, now people are starting to realize that the United States adopted a country the size of France and has adopted a war against a superpower, and they are almost solely funding it, right? That there's problems that the United States has here. Now, of course, Bakhmut, let's say Soledar falls, Bakhmut falls, troops start falling back. What about this term collapse, where you get a military, an economic, an infrastructural, a collapse where things just kind of come together to a point where it's not sustainable for Ukraine to keep doing this thing, even though they got some troops here and here. You see what I'm getting at. And I'm sure you've seen that happen before historically with military.
Sure. I mean, you know, the ideal collapse for the Russians would be something akin to the collapse of the destruction of Army Group Center that took place in the summer of 1944, Operation Bagration. And we're talking over 1 million Germans taken off the battlefield. Significant. And it was, but you know, I just have to remind people that when you take a look at the casualties, even though the Germans suffered egregiously, you take a look at the Russian casualties going, holy cow.
Right.
They took some serious casualties too. War ain't cheap, especially if you're fighting against an enemy that is hardened and capable as the Ukrainians are. Let's just stop pretending that they're incompetent cowards. They're not. Even those bastards in the Adar and Azov and Tornado and Kraken, as much as I dislike and viscerally hate these people, I have to tell you that if I went opposite on the field of battle, I'd be briefing my Marines to treat them seriously. These guys will kill you if you give them the chance to do so. And now we come to the concern. Another collapse would be what happened to the Germans around in the vicinity of Kharkov during 1943, the winter of 1943, after the Battle of Stalingrad, when the Sixth Army, the Romanians, the Hungarians, the Italians, everybody just disappeared. There's this giant hole in the lines. And the Germans are trying to plug it by, I think, pulling out 4th Panzer Army out of the Caucasus as quick as they can to bring them in. And this general named von Manstein arrived on the battlefield, and he couldn't create a coherent front. But what he did is, as the Soviets pushed through this gap, they created opportunities because they got overextended. I think my history, right? Popov's tank army, a shock force, was trying to make a move through the German rear, and von Manstein was able to cut them off, bloody their nose, wipe them out, push them back. And by doing this, through this war of maneuver, he was able to reconstitute a defensive line that held. And the reason why I bring that up is, you know, the Ukrainians have some capable units that are still intact. And so even though let's say there's a collapse at Bakhmut, mm-hmm. a collapse at Soledar, and the Russians go forward, I got to tell you, if I was a Russian command, I would basically have anti-collapse built into my plan, meaning that we'll manage their collapse. Mm-hmm. Because what we don't want to do is get in a situation where we overextend ourselves and give them a chance to pull a von Manstein and cut off our troops and hit us and all that. That you want to make sure that as you move forward, all your flanks are secure, that as you move forward, you have, you know, defense in depth, just in case the Ukrainians launch a counterattack at a point and penetrate, that you can seal that off and not have to worry about any major disruption. So even though I believe the potential for the kind of collapse you're talking about exists, I think the Russians have to keep in mind that even though they have a lot of troops coming in right now, you know, if you suffer a lot of casualties, then you don't have a lot of troops anymore. And there is a big mission out there that's going to require a lot of troops so that you don't repeat the mistakes of September in Kharkov, where you had a thinly held line, or in Kherson, where you had a line that was indefensible because you lacked the forces to push the enemy back and make a more secure line. So you had no choice but to fall back in the opposite direction. I think you have got a lot of guys that are looking at the maps and they're coming up with phase lines. And I think this is going to be a very phased approach to offensive warfare, where each phase will be followed by a pause. And then there are certain prerequisites that have to be achieved in terms of securing flanks, getting logistics up, et cetera, before you go to the next phase. And this will be a little bit bloodier for everybody involved. You know, it'll take a little bit more time, but the end result is going to be an absolute decisive Russian victory as they shape the battlefield exactly the way they want it to look. There will be no surprises. They know right now that Ukraine's got 30 to 40,000 troops in Europe getting trained right now, that sometime in the spring, 2 to 3 brigades worth of armored troops are going to show up, and Russia needs to be prepared for that. What they don't want to do is create a situation where they've overextended themselves, and right at that moment of overextension, the Ukrainians hit them with 2 to 3 brigades, and suddenly the Russians, they're not going to lose the war, but suddenly they have that political problem again. Oh, we're retreating. Oh, we're giving up land that we captured. Oh, we're not winning decisively. I think Russia needs to be winning decisively from now on. I'm not saying there won't be a tactical reversal here or there, but the day of the major Ukrainian counterattack, from a political perspective, has to be over. And literally speaking, there's no reason for the Ukrainians ever to have that opportunity again, because the Russians have the force structure necessary to make sure that wherever the Ukrainians seek to attack, they're banging their head against the wall. Right now, there's no place on the line that Ukrainians can get a major breakthrough. But once the Russians start moving, you create the potential. You have units that can outrun their, you know, they're not linked up anymore. They create gaps. And unless you pause, identify the gaps and close them rapidly, you know, an enemy, especially one that has the intelligence support that they're getting from the United States, could be able to exploit that. So I think this is going to be a far more measured offensive than what circumstances might otherwise dictate. Because I'm not disagreeing with you about the potential for the Ukrainians to collapse, but I just don't think that the Russians are going to be playing, you know, that kind of, you know, rapid exploitation game, because this isn't World War II. They don't have 12 million guys.
Right.
You know, they have limited resources. They have resources finally sufficient to the task, but they won't be sufficient if Russia squanders them on, you know, trying to seize too much too soon and giving the Ukrainians a chance to counterattack.
It sounds to me like you're saying the Russians, they learned when they came in here, they came in and let's say they hit an area, they knock out some Ukrainian troops, and there was nothing but open field, open space. And they just buzzed across that open space until they hit something. And people said, well, they've got that open space. Well, they didn't really, because there was nothing there. And they didn't plan to have people to hold what they had. And it got kind of in disarray. And it sounds to me like what you're saying is, okay, they take an area and there's nothing but open space and they can make a mad race to the river. They ain't making a mad race to the river this time, that they're going to make a determination as to how far they want to move next. We also see them just with the new general digging in places, just digging in. That the places they have, there's going to be no more, we don't have enough people here. They're coming back in and take it. If you're going to come back in and take a space this time, it ain't going to be an easy job.
Yeah, and I think you're going to see with the advances, like you said, I believe it's probably going to be phased. Again, I'm not on with the Russian general staff, and there's probably some Russian colonel right now going, Ritter, you're an idiot. That's not what we're going to do. You're a fool. We're going to do the exact opposite. Okay, that's your war, man. I'm not fighting it for you. I'm just, you know, saying from my perspective, given, you know, what the lessons of history, I believe that the Russians will probably run a very phased operation and making sure at each phase to consolidate their positions so that the Ukrainians can never again launch a counterattack that achieves the kind of depth of penetration that they did back in September.
Now, do the Belarusian troops also serve as a reserve force? They hit an area, they got some issues, or they need extra troops, or they can draw from the reserves in Belarus also, or do you think that Belarusian contingent stays there for all the reasons that you've put up early, and that's probably they're not going to draw off of them?
Let me put it this way. Even if, let's say, Russia decided to attack towards Kiev, I don't think a Belarusian soldier is going to cross the border.
Right. The Russian forces there. So the Russian forces and the Belarusian forces are kind of married in a group there. And if they got to act, you think they act together?
I think so. I personally don't see the Russians launching, at least initially, a major strike towards Kiev. You know, here's the thing. Let's say the war is developing and Russia's achieving these breakthroughs, and the Ukrainians are forced to strip defenses north of Kiev. And if the Russians may look at the map and go, wow, we have a golden opportunity right now to strike. But I personally don't believe they're going to do it, because they tried that once and it didn't work too well. So I don't imagine that they're going to, you know, double down on stupid. You know, if the Ukrainians surrender and you need a force to come in and secure Kiev, then that force is there. But I think that this force works best as a force in potential. And it's also limited by, you know, Belarusian President Lukashenko has said straight up, we're not here to invade Ukraine. It's not our job. We're here to protect the Russian flank. We're here to protect Russia and Belarus from NATO, further NATO aggression. One of their big concerns is Poland moving into Western Ukraine. Lukashenko said that is a red line. If Poland moves in, then we will have no choice. And that's where this joint group comes into play, because it can respond effectively to any Polish incursion, which I think puts the Poles in check. They're also putting the Ukrainians in check. So I think that's the purpose of that force. I don't see that force moving in. And if they did preemptively, or, you know, I think it would only be the Russians. Again, I don't know. I don't know what kind of deal the Ukrainians and the Russians and the Belarusians have cut. But I have listened to the Belarusian president speak, and he's been consistent from day one that it's not the job of Belarus to invade Ukraine, that Belarus is here to defend from Polish aggression or Ukrainian aggression against Belarus, but Belarusian forces aren't there to invade or occupy Ukraine.
Not a lot much more that I want to get to, but I do want to ask you about the latest. You know, we heard the Wonder Weapon stuff for I don't know how long. Okay. Now we're hearing there was an article in The Washington Post. I'm sure you're familiar with it. Robert Gates and Condoleezza Rice. The way I read it was a certain level of desperation. The way I read it was they were saying to Europe, empty your stores, whatever you got left. You know, I know you've been holding out, but whatever you got left, throw it on Ukraine now. Give them what you have. And then immediately after this, we hear, OK, the French, they're giving these kind of, you know, they're giving their news more odds and ends. And again, I just think, how can you do a mismatch of weapons that aren't networked together? And then and I put it like this. I'm Ukrainian and I got stuff with French instructions, with Belgian instructions, with German instructions, or even if I have the mercenaries, those people haven't necessarily worked together in this environment. There's a certain air of desperation, and it seems to me they're throwing their equipment into a trash compactor. That the Russians have this giant, and I put it like this, the Russians don't really have to move on things because they've set up a trash compactor. And I know it sounds cold, but that NATO's just throwing its weapons into the trash compactor. And yes, they are taking some hits, but they're just blowing these things to hell. And now the NATO's going to throw some more weapons in the trash compactor.
Yeah, it's look, you know, I forget how many, you know, French tanks, the AMX-10, it's a wheeled vehicle. It's not really a tank. I think it'd be classified as a light tank on best, or a you know, a medium armored car, but it has a survivability factor of zero in modern combat. The Bradley, you know, which variant are they getting? Are they getting the one with all the bells and whistles, the upgraded variant? Are they getting old ones that have been mothballed that are going to be brought out, like the old M113s that we brought out, you know, made to function and then turned over? The same thing with the Marder. That's a German infantry fighting vehicle. Are they getting the new ones with all the bells and whistles? Or are they getting ones that have to be brought out, refitted, repaired, and then turned over?
The Marder, that's an ironic name, particularly in this conflict. But let's continue.
Yeah, but my point is what? It's 50 Bradleys, 80 Marders. That's 130. You know, Zaluzhny said back in November he needed 500. He ain't getting 500 on tanks. He said he needed 300. He's not getting anywhere near 300. You know, there's some talk about people providing Leopards and all that, but they haven't crossed that line yet. The British are talking about the Challenger 2. You know, when all these tanks came out, they were gee whiz tanks. But these aren't brand new tanks. These are old tanks, and more importantly, they're old tanks that the Russians have been spending years preparing to defeat in combat. You know, the Challenger 2 wasn't designed to take on the T-90, you know, MB3 or whatever the variant is out there. You know, its armor can't survive being hit by the Russian anti-tank rounds. The Russians outgunned them, outranged them, and it's, you know, I might be able to say if they were fighting the British, yeah, but you got some really good British crew. I mean, you know this. If you take a guy who's, you know, driven the same Camaro his entire life, and he knows everything about that Camaro, every sound, noise, he knows exactly when to do this. So he can take a machine that isn't as efficient as others, but he knows how to get the best out of it all the time. He might win the race, even if he's racing faster cars. But, So we take a Ukrainian crew and we put them in a Challenger 2, and they don't know anything about this tank. They don't know, so they're out there sort of trying to get a feel for it. They don't know how to maximize its pluses, and they don't know how to minimize its minuses. Meanwhile, they're going up against a T-90, MB3 tank. Goodbye, desvidaniya. That's all she wrote. You're going to die. I feel bad for the Ukrainians. I really do, because, let's say you're Ukrainian now launching an offensive. Remember, every army prepares to fight the last battle. So the Ukrainians' last offensive battle was one where they were able to achieve great penetrations through thinly held defenses. And now they're going to come in and they're going to try and replicate that. But if the Russians do what I said they should be doing, which is a phased operation, linking in everything, these guys are going to try and come rushing in, and they're just going to get hit right in the face. They're going down. It's going to get ugly quick. And because they don't have 500 infantry fighting vehicles, they're going to run out of oomph really quick. I think, all this does is extend the battle, the Russian offensive by a couple weeks, because the Russians will have to, of course, defeat these three brigades when they're thrown in on the battlefield. But the Russians will defeat them, and then the Ukrainians will have nothing, and they'll move on. I mean, what happens when you destroy 50 Bradleys? Because they're going to be destroyed. What's to replace them? I can tell you what's going to happen if the Ukrainians destroy 50 BMP-2 or BMP-3 armored fighting vehicles. The Russians have 50 more that'll come in that quick. The Russians ain't going to run out of equipment. Their defense industry, I mean, NATO hasn't woken up to the fact that, Putin signed off on a new prikaz or directive that expands the Russian military to 1.5 million. They're going to increase the contract soldiers, but they're also going to increase conscription. They're forming a whole bunch of new airborne units, a whole bunch of new Marine units. These are forces that are expeditionary in nature. So they aren't linked to a specific geographical region. They can be brought in to do things, more artillery. In order to support all this, their defense industry is already ramped up. They're already producing at max efficiency. Weapons are already coming off the production line. Meanwhile, back in Western Europe, ain't nothing like that happening. Poland is building a single division. They're equipping it with equipment that they don't produce. Other people do, but they're going to buy old M1 tanks. They're going to buy new tanks from the South Koreans. It's going to take time. But then that's it. What's Germany doing? What's France doing? What's Belgium doing? What's Netherlands doing? What's Denmark doing? What's NATO doing? And the answer is nothing comparable. Literally, what's the United States doing? I mean, if I were an American military planner right now, I'd be telling the President of the United States, we need to activate 3 armored divisions right now. Not because we need them today, but just so they're available in 2 years. But we need to get 3 divisions up and running. Now, they'll come back to me and say, we have a recruiting shortfall of 6,000. I don't know where you think you're going to get the troops to do this. And that's a different question altogether. Leadership will have to come up with a solution. But the bottom line is, if we think we're going to take on the Russians, and I'm not talking about force on force, but
right,
make a presence known, we need to have forces capable of establishing and sustaining a presence. And we're not doing that.
Well, I can say this as a person who was a former hovercraft pilot when I did search and rescue on the bay. That Slingsby Aviation, SAH 2200 hovercraft. I could take that thing and run it 50 knots across the ice. I could do a 180 and use the prop wash to stop it. I ran that thing every day. If you don't know what you're doing with that, and I try to train you a couple weeks and you run that thing off the ice, you are dead. When you get up to 50 knots, you will never get it stopped. And it's flipping and you're done and you're never going to come home again alive. So a very expensive piece of equipment made in England. So I understand what you're saying when it comes to, I can give you the best tank in the world. If you don't know what you're doing with it A, you might just kill yourself running off something or going, you know, or screwing it up. If not, God knows when you come up against a tank crew or a tank division of people who have practiced maneuvering together, they're going to go through you like a hot knife through butter.
Yeah. Or as General Patton said, like crap through a goose.
Yeah, exactly. Or crap or what, shit through a tin horn. I've heard that one too, all too many times. Last but not least, I think we've pretty much covered everything. Is there anything that you think that's important that our viewers need to know that you'd like to comment on?
No, I mean, I just like to bring it down to reality that this isn't Call of Duty. This isn't Medal of Honor. This isn't Fortnite. This isn't a video game. This is real. People are dying on both sides. And, you know, just people should reflect on that when they talk about, you know, these sort of academic exercises of, you know, how many armored vehicles can we provide? How much ammunition? Every you know, quota of material that you're providing to the Ukrainians will eventually be married up to manpower, and they'll be put into combat where they're probably going to die. And they're going to be dying in a cause that's unwinnable. And so the longer we continue to provide weapons and equipment to the Ukrainians, the longer we sustain the suffering of the Ukrainian nation. And we need to understand that at some point in time, you know, their defense minister just came out and sort of bragged. I don't understand why he said what he said, but he's bragging that that they are the tool of NATO, that they are doing NATO's dirty work, that they're dying for NATO. You know, someday people may hunt him down and lynch him like they lynched other traitors or Mussolini. I'm not hoping that on the guy, but my God, you're bragging about allowing your nation to be sacrificed on behalf of NATO is what he's bragging about. And that's shameful.
Well, if you could watch about 2 minutes of video with me and comment, I've been showing this stuff lately, and I think it's important for people to see. To see what's going on in America, as we send $120 billion to Ukraine, as we have the new B-2 Raider nuclear stealth bomber that's $550 million each that they want to buy 100 with, 100 now. I want to show people this is what's going on in America. Scott, let's look at this about a minute. This is right now. In Oakland, California, and it's all over California. This is a guy just driving around California. This is America. I grew up in America. You grew up. We're just about the same age. When I grew up, if you went to Oakland, California, you know what you saw? You saw businesses. If you went to Oakland, California, you saw people that had jobs. These stores were open back then. People worked there. Now we're spending all of that money. Let me go a little further. These are homeless camps here, giant homeless camps. And this is not one here and there. They're all over the place in California. You see, and all over the place. See, there we go. Homeless camps. You'll see cars at the homeless camps. You see RVs because people look at them. Look at the size of them. They're all over the place because there are a lot of people there who have cars because they have a job. But they can't afford to live. They're living in squalor. There used to be a time when you go outside of Lagos, Nigeria, and you'd see that when you'd go to various places around the world, as tragic as it may be. But all of these are trucks and buses and anything that people can find to live in. They park because they can't afford a home. There's signs everywhere in Oakland, California, in Fresno, in Sacramento, but you can go to Alaska. You can go all over the country and you can find this and you'll see signs that say, don't leave anything in your car. Don't leave anything in the open because the people are so desperate. These are not lazy people. These people used to have a job. These people used to work in factories. These people used to be able to feed their families. Now their children. I'm a person, I have a daughter, thankfully she's grown, but I cannot imagine living in this kind of squalor. And I'm just going to leave it at that, Scott. And as I see that, and I understand that right now we've adopted a country the size of France, and we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars. $1 billion would clean all of those, clean all of them up, put maybe some places for people to live, some something, disease, everything will go there. That's what America is turning into. Before we leave, Scott, I'd just like to get your comments on it.
No, I agree absolutely. I think people should start talking in terms of not, one B-21 bomber costing X, but to say that B-21 bomber could, build, 150 residential, facilities capable of housing this many people. It could clean up water. I mean, take one B-21, you could clean up all the water in Flint, Michigan, which still isn't cleaned up because nobody can afford it. One B-21 could solve the problems of the hurricane damage down in Florida, which everybody's forgotten about. I mean, we're very good at when the dramatic wind is blowing and, the TV anchors can get blown around and look really sexy doing it. Everybody says, oh, my gosh, we care. But now nobody cares. Nobody's talking about them. Nobody's doing anything. But we're going to buy more weapons and we're going to send more war materiel to the most corrupt nation on the planet, underwriting a Nazi ideology that's as odious as it is, just evil. Americans have to start recalibrating their brain. First of all, we have to start caring. I mean, I just what you showed me, the problem is out of sight, out of mind. I mean, if I'm in Albany, New York, that's a California problem. I just pretend it doesn't exist, except problem in Albany is I can take you, it's not quite as extensive as that, but I can take you where the tents are, where the cardboard boxes are. You can do it anywhere. It's there. It's an American problem. It's an American reality. And yet we're so callous and just throwing money away at a losing cause. There's not a single person out there that can articulate a strategy of victory for Ukraine that is real. Yes, there's talking heads out there that say, Ukraine will win. That's not a strategy. Tell me how they're going to do it. Tell me exactly, step by step. You see, I could do the opposite. I can sit here and tell you how I think Russia is going to win. And it's logic, it's fact-based, etc. No one could do the same thing for Ukraine. No one can sit there and, build capability where the components don't exist. And yet we're going to pour all this money, literally waste this money. This is money gone forever. And meanwhile, back here in America, Americans, our fellow citizens, are suffering, as you showed. So, yeah, I think there's a disconnect here. Somehow we got to find a way to get the American people to wake up to what's going on at home and figure out that the best national security our country can have begins with good infrastructure, jobs, healthcare, education, homes. Criticize Russia all you want. I'll say this. It's a constitutional right to have a home in Russia.
Wow. Scott, where can people find you online? And, oh, by the way, I forgot, you're back on Twitter.
Well, it's the original Twitter account. So it's at Real Scott Ritter on Twitter. I have Scott Ritter on Telegram. And, of course, if you want all my writings and everything, ScottRitterExtra.com. is the one shop stop for anything I do. For instance, when you send me a link to this podcast, I'll put it up on that. I put all my writing on that and everything. So ScottRitterExtra.com.
Can people become members or anything at Scott Ritter Extra, or is it just?
Well, I because I am the world's worst businessman, and because I have this policy that if I'm going to do this, it should be available to everybody. SkyRaiderExtra.com is a subscription service, but the subscription costs you nothing if you want it to cost you nothing. But if you like what you see on there, then you have the opportunity to either subscribe on a monthly basis, an annual basis, or donate whatever you want. And believe me, when you make a living writing, I mean, this is a full-time job. It's become literally a full-time job. And people claim to like what I'm doing. So if you do, then please help out, because, if I have to go find alternative means of securing income, then I won't be able to do this. I'll have to go do something else, whether it's digging trenches, roofing homes. I'm
Yeah, I used to sell.
There'll be something else I'll have to do.
I used to sell networked security and video cameras. Trust me, I know it. Everybody go to ScottRitterExtra.com, right? That's it, yeah. ScottRitterExtra.com. And make sure that you become, get a subscription there. Donate, become a paying subscriber on ScottRitterExtra.com. I'm asking everybody there to go there. Scott does incredible work. We really appreciate it. And let me tell you this, he's on all the time. Anybody that calls him, he doesn't ask for a dime to do it. So everybody go to ScottRitterExtra.com. I'm asking you to go there to get a monthly subscription, whatever you can do, whatever you can afford to help keep Scott going. And we really appreciate it. It's a show and let him know that we really appreciate his work and we want to support him and keep him going. Thanks a lot. My name is Garland Nixon, at Garland Nixon on Twitter, Garland.Nixon on Instagram, just plain old Garland Nixon on Facebook, Facebook, and all of the rest of them mostly. But, and of course, I'm on Rockfin. That's ROKFIN, Rockfin.com/GarlandNixon. In case they toss me off Twitter, you can always go to Rockfin and find me. Thanks a lot, Scott. Thanks. And don't forget, everybody, Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock, Scott will be back, and I'm sure we're going to have big things going. Who knows what might have happened in Solidar within the next 24 hours. Thanks a lot, Scott, and thank you, everyone. We're out.
Thanks, Scott.